Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello everybody, it's Jack from Cultaholic back again with Matches of the Month for February. Just a bit of housekeeping to start things off because there was a couple of matches that I forgot to mention in the January edition of Matches of the Month, which were pointed out to me on Twitter. So thank you to UNG for Joe versus Hook, which was the AEW title match, which was, I enjoyed it. I should have mentioned it. I thought it was exactly what a Hook title match should have been. Thank you also to Noah Stock, who recommended Okada, Ishii and Tanahashi versus TMDK over in New Japan. Okada's last match in Kurikan, I believe. Yeah, I thought that was a great send-off for Okada, and it got Fujita over well as a newcomer in the other team. So, yes, thank you to those guys on Twitter for mentioning those matches that I forgot about. I'm tremendously embarrassed. But now, let's press forth with Matches of the Month for February. There's only one place to start, really, which is quite interesting. I want to talk about not one of the major promotions, not WWE, not AEW, not even New Japan. I want to start in Rev Pro.
Heavy is the head that wears the crown. Don't worry, Michael Oku. Will Ospreay is going to lighten your load for you tonight. That's the look of a man that has been here before. Stood in the ring against Will Ospreay before, has felt the violence that Will Ospreay can inflict upon his body, has felt helpless against Will Ospreay before, and still has stepped in there to do it one more time.
There was a match at RevPro that kind of caught the attention of the wrestling world in February. It was a title match for the British Heavyweight Championship. It was described by Dave Meltzer as one of the best matches he'd ever seen. I think he gave it 6 stars. Put however much stock into that as you want. And I'm going to give my thoughts on it as well. It was Will Ospreay versus Michael Oku. Before I delve into this, I want to just clarify. I mean, everyone knows I'm a big Ospreay fan. Michael Oku, I think, is a tremendous wrestler as well, because I couldn't not start off with this match, given the fact that many have already christened it Match of the Year, or at least a frontrunner for Match of the Year. So the background to the match, this was Ospreay's farewell to British wrestling before he headed off to AEW full-time. In the UK promotion, I'd say he's most associated with, which is Rev Pro. Here, he's challenging Michael Oku, as I say, for the British Heavyweight Championship. And even though Oku's the champion, he's also the underdog. 2 years ago, these guys had a match in 2022. Ospreay won. Everybody loved it. Meltzer gave it 5 stars. And in that case, 2 years ago, I did not enjoy it as much as other people seemed to. And again, I'm a huge fan of both wrestlers. So when, because of that, with that knowledge that I was kind of lower on that initial match than many people were. When I heard this rematch get the praise it was getting, yeah, my initial reaction, I was a little bit skeptical. You know, 6 stars from Meltzer and all that, one of the greatest matches he's ever seen, he said. I was like, right, I think I know what's happened here. But I tried to go in with an open mind, and this is what I thought. First of all, it's a long match, like 40 plus minutes. And obviously, given the talent involved, the in-ring work is excellent. Both of them are phenomenal wrestlers. I have no issues at all either with the story positioning Oku as the next Ospreay, like taking the torch from him, the leader of the next generation of UK talent in Ospreay's absence and all that. Yeah, I agreed with all that. But now, here's my broader opinion of the match itself. I thought the first half was fantastic. It set the scene really well. Ospreay very cocky and dominant early on. Oku fighting bravely back and then working the legs, setting Ospreay up for the half crab, which is his signature submission. The crowd throughout the match were on fire. Excellent, excellent crowd in London. We get both men busted open. Both slingshot each other into the ring posts on the outside of the ring. Ospreay kicks Oku's manager and real life wife, I believe, Amira, for spitting on him. And then there was a bit of unintentional comedy here, actually, which I thought was fine. It didn't affect the match. It's just that, you know, Oku sees Ospreay kick his partner and obviously flies into a rage, hitting Ospreay with the most vengeful move of all, the Sami Zayn through the ropes tornado DDT. Yes, Michael, let the hate flow through you. But no, that was a minor quibble. The first half of the match I thought was brilliant. And I thought, wow, I am seeing what people see when they say this match is excellent. And I was really enjoying it. And I thought, wow, maybe the hype was legit. And I checked the runtime on the match and there was still, what, 20 minutes left to go? And it seemed to already be building to a natural crescendo. And I thought, uh-oh. So my problem with that first match they had back in 2022 was that, in my opinion, it tried to do a bit too much. It felt a bit overblown. And while, again, in that instance, the work was really, really top-notch, really good, I thought it just had a bit too much going on in the name of melodrama, in the name of trying to make an epic match. And unfortunately, I do think this rematch last month fell into the very same trap. And fair enough if you disagree with me, and I'm prepared to get a bit of a backlash for this opinion because I know a lot of people love this match. And fair enough, I totally respect your opinion if you thought that. But here's my issue. I thought here they were trying to tell like three big, important stories at once, all jammed into this one main event. And if these three big intertwining stories had all been separated into a trilogy of matches or whatever, or a series, great. You know, each match could have had its own distinct theme, its own distinct story that it was trying to tell. Here, I thought, as I say, it felt jammed in for me. I'll explain. So first and foremost, you've got the story of the match itself on the surface. You've got the story of Ospreay as the arrogant challenger, but the arrogant favorite, thinking he's better. And Oku trying to prove that he is a worthy opponent, trying to take this torch from Ospreay, as I say, on Will's way out of British wrestling. We've also got the second story of callbacks to their previous match. And in that 2022 match, Ospreay hit several hidden blades on Oku, covering him and then breaking his own pinfall attempts. Now here in the rematch, Oku does this to Ospreay the other way around, and he's passing up his chance to win the match several times. And while I do enjoy a callback to a previous match, I don't know if I can like bring myself to enjoy it as much when it's calling back to something that I wasn't a particular fan of in the first place. But moreover, this happened and felt very much like the climax of the match, these hidden blades and Oku breaking his own falls, and he's building up a head of steam, but he's kind of becoming hubristic and arrogant. And that felt like the climax of the match. That felt like the ending of a story. And then the match went on for another like 10, 15 minutes after that. Then, on top of all of this, you've got this third story, in my opinion, of Amira getting involved. And she's, you know, she's a key part of several big moments here. You know, she's part of the rules. If she throws in the towel, then Oku loses. Later on, she's getting kicked by Ospreay. They have an argument on the outside. She spits on him because he's dabbed the towel that she can throw in if she wants in Oku's bloody face. And he's like thrust the towel at her and she spits at him and he kicks her. And I thought that was good. And by the way, I said both guys were great. I thought her performance was brilliant as well. You know, I don't have an issue with the match on a work level, if that makes sense. It's more the bigger picture that I have an issue with. So anyway, she gets kicked by Ospreay. It leads to Oku firing up. Later on, she ends up in the ring and saves Oku from the Hidden Blade. She pushes him out of the way and takes the bullet herself. And then at the end, she's even part of the finish, which is that Oku catches Ospreay in the half crab, his submission finisher, as I've mentioned. He wrenches all the way back, and she's there on the outside of the ring to flip Ospreay off through the ropes. And yes, it makes sense in the build-up because she has clashed with Ospreay in the build-up to this. She has been as much a part of it as Oku has. And I don't think this was a bit of improv from her either, because Ospreay like moved around in the submission to face her side of the ring, and the camera got a good shot of her doing it. It was a plan. It was very much, it felt like at least a planned part of the finish. So there's all this stuff going on. There's the match itself with its own inherent story. There's the callbacks to the previous match. So it's also acting as quite like a sequel. And you've got this third party involvement as well, very crucially as well. So, and I was going to maybe forgive all of that because it did feel like they were jamming three different finishes to three different stories into what should have just been one finish. And I was maybe willing to forgive that when Oku hit Mad Kurt's finish, the Sega Mega Driver. Mad Kurt, obviously a British indie wrestler, a friend of many people in the scene who sadly passed away. And it was a wonderful tribute. Oku hitting this move, which is a wonderful looking move. He delivers it really well. Ospreay takes it really well. The crowd reaction proves that it is a genuinely brilliant moment. Even if you have no idea that that's Kurt's finisher, the crowd reaction makes you realize, oh, something's just happened here, because they come unglued. It is a genuine, brilliant wrestling moment because it mixes in real life emotions as well. And I think that would have worked as the finish. But it's not, because this match has so much going on. Oku goes up top after this move, hits a frog splash, goes back up, hits another frog splash, half crab, and then you've got the flipping off spot from the outside, and that's the finish. And yeah, man, it's crazy. It's finish on finish on finish. It's story on story on top of story. And like I say, if this had been spread over several different matches, maybe with a different element of the story taking center stage each time, brilliant. It would have been brilliant. But as it stands, this, unfortunately, this was a bit too much for me. And I feel like such a dick saying that, because all three people involved in the match put in a hell of a lot of effort here. Wonderful performances, on a work rate level. I don't know if I can honestly make myself shower it with praise as many others have, and I feel bad for that because I am a fan of everyone involved, and I thought it was a very ambitious match, but that might be the issue. It might have been too ambitious for my own personal taste. Again, no problem at all if you thought it was match of the year. Of course, it's just my opinion. But yeah, that is my opinion, and unfortunately, I have to be honest about that in this podcast. I'm so sorry if you are screaming at your listening device right now. There was another match on the undercard that I thought was worth mentioning as well. Zack Sabre Jr. versus Connor Mills, which was very patient technical stuff. It felt almost more like a Zack Sabre Jr. match of a few years ago, before he had his TV title reign in New Japan, which saw him speed things up a bit because of that belt's 15-minute time limit. This match was longer. It went about 20, and it had a strange rhythm, but not a bad one by any means. I'm not saying that. I think both did some really intricate stuff. Some of it felt quite improvised. And then down the stretch, obviously, there were more planned moments as well as things got to the business end of the match. I'm certainly aware of Connor Mills, by the way, and I have been for many years, but through totally my own fault, I haven't watched too many singles matches involving him. And I was definitely impressed by him here. Zack Sabre Jr. kind of predictably got the win, though, not via submission, which was interesting. I thought that was an interesting choice of ending. Maybe RevPro are interested in keeping Mills as this technical wizard, this sort of protege of Zack's style. And he lost instead, not via submission or getting caught in a roll-up or something technical. He lost because of several big penalty kicks to the chest, which I think kind of protects him in a strange way, more than it would have been to lose to Zack at his own game. So yeah, nice stuff. But it did get overshadowed. I mean, everything on the show got slightly overshadowed by that main event. So, yeah, that's what I thought of RevPro High Stakes, which certainly caught the headlines and seems to have impressed people, even if I wasn't particularly a fan of that big main event, but a lot of people were. So congratulations to RevPro there. We'll move on to the next section, which is one of the major promotions, and it's New Japan Pro Wrestling.
無限のサブミッション対決。ザ・フロントマン、ザック・セイバー・ジュニア。ジ・アメリカン・ドラゴン、ブライアン・ダニエルソン。
You didn't beat me by submission. You chickened out. We'll find out in the rematch who the best technical wrestler in the world.
You have been in New Japan for years and years and years. He's never once tapped Okada out. Who tapped Okada out on their very first try? Brian Danielson. This time, I'm coming to tap you out.
Next time, you tap out.
Zack Sabre Jr. has no fighting spirit.
You want a question? My fighting spirit. Not this time, Brian. If you don't knock me out, I'm breaking your f***ing spirit, darling.
テクニック世界一の称号は俺がもらう。
I am the best technical wrestler.
Brian Danielson, the best technical wrestler in the world.
We are heading to the New Beginning in Osaka show, which featured two matches in particular I want to focus on. The first one, another Zack Sabre Jr. match, this time taking on Brian Danielson. Now, their match last year at Wrestle Dream was really strong. I think it was my second favourite match of 2023. I enjoyed this one slightly less, but I still really enjoyed it. I thought it was an excellent technical display. And whereas the first match, I described it as a game of one-upmanship, both guys kind of showing off and trying to embarrass each other and outdo each other, this one felt more serious, more gritty and mean. And I think my enjoyment of it grew as the match developed, which was good. I also like the tie-in to last time, or at least what I interpreted as the tie-in. I don't know if it was deliberate or not. I hope it was. Because last time, Brian won, of course, when he ditched the technical stuff and went a bit more, not sports entertaining, but a bit more big moves and strikes and stuff. This time, though, when he tried to do that and tried to ditch the technical stuff and tried to hit, you know, the running knee and everything, Zach was always there to drag him back down. So Brian's trying to basically pick the match up off the canvas and run around. And Zach's trying to keep him down in the mud, you know? I thought that was a good story. Brian went for the knee, which he won the last match with, hit it, but then foolishly went for a second one, and it gave Zach another opening, which led to the finishing stretch. And there was a nice exchange of pinfall attempts, which were really ingenious at times. And Zach eventually won with, I think, like a crucifix pin, and managed to pin Brian Danielson and get revenge for last year's result. So yeah, this was really nice stuff. In terms of a rematch, and you think, is this going to be a good match or not? Yes, it was. And I think that was maybe the least surprising great rematch given the talent involved. So well done to those two. And there was another match on the show as well, which was the main event, which went an hour plus. The 10-man tag team cage match, kind of war game rules in effect. You've got a cage around the ring and you've got staggered entrances. And it was the United Empire versus the Bullet Club War Dogs. These are my dogs for real, as the theme tune goes. United Empire was the team of Will Ospreay, Jeff Cobb, Hanare, Francesco Akira, and TJP. And the Bullet Club War Dogs were David Finlay, Gabe Kidd, Driller Maloney, Clark Connors, and Alex Coughlin. The great irony here, and I'm aware of the hypocrisy, is I criticised the very much loved Ospreay-Oku match just before for doing too much. This match did so much as well, but I just couldn't help but love it. I'm sorry, I couldn't help it. It maybe went slightly too long, because, you know, it was an hour plus. But I will say this, for an hour plus match to feel like it only went slightly too long is crazy. Like, I thought that was really impressive. I don't know how they kept it so fresh throughout. This is basically, as I say, a War Games match, staggered entry and everything. The cage around the ring was set slightly further back, so they had more of the ringside area to work with. And it led to so much stuff happened in this match, you know. I know I said that there was the too much storytelling going on in the Ospreay-Oku match. This had a lot of things happening, a lot of violence, a lot of kind of inventive stuff that may or may not have paid off, depending on your opinion. But I think the reason I like this more than the previous one is because it was all focused around one story, just a big story with lots of stuff happening. And that story was the story of hatred. Everything you could think of in this type of match was in here. Like, this was one of my favorite, I think, representations of a War Games match, even though it didn't fall under that official banner. There was lots of blood, obviously. There was thumbtacks, there were tables, there was leaping off the cage. Gabe Kidd did the ladder around the head spot, spinning around like a helicopter. We had Jeff Cobb doing, I think, the single best no-sell of a kendo stick to the back I've ever seen. Akira was a star in this match, firing up and this plucky underdog babyface getting the crowd fully behind him. There was barbed wire all over the place. There was people stabbing each other with forks. There was so much stuff. I couldn't begin to cover all the stuff. Obviously, it went an hour plus, so there was a lot of stuff here. And the violence had certain elements of a Japanese death match, which makes sense. They were in Japan, of course. But it was one of the least New Japan, specifically, one of the least New Japan-style main events in New Japan I've ever seen. And I couldn't help but imagine the crowd thinking, what the hell are these like crazy Westerners doing to each other? Excellent, though. I really enjoyed it. Also, kind of, it was also Ospreay's like farewell to New Japan and everything. And I think the cool thing about it was it actually shone a spotlight on everyone else in the match. Not so much Ospreay until the end. He started the match off with Finlay. They had 5 minutes. Then the other entrances began, and Ospreay featured heavily at the end. But for the most part, he spent most of this match either getting battered by his opponents, making them look really good in the process, or selling on the outside. This match was as much about everybody else in it as it was about Will Ospreay, which was a very wise decision. Things down the stretch started getting legitimately terrifying as the heels took apart the ring, these damn war dogs, and they pulled up the canvas, and you've got moves being executed on the loose boards of the ring now. And the boards are like shifting and falling away beneath their feet. It's a miracle it didn't lead to anybody getting seriously injured, but it also was really cool, like really enjoyable. I wouldn't want to see it happen all the time, but it felt really dangerous and was, but it worked. The risk paid off. The ending came with like Ospreay defending Akira, who'd given his all and was just spent, and Ospreay like pushes him out of the ring and faces all of the heel team on his own, and obviously they beat him. And it really worked for me. I thought it was excellent. And I know that I do sound like a hypocrite because I've gone from one really maximalist match saying I found it to be not as good as everybody said to another really over-the-top maximalist match, which I loved more than a lot of people seem to even. But yeah, it makes sense in my head, I suppose. And another New Japan match to mention as well was in the build-up to this cage match. It was one of the matches that acted as kind of a prelude to it. On one of the Road to New Beginning shows, which was Gabe Kidd versus Hanare. This was probably the pick of the matches in the build, I believe. I think it was the pick of like the skirmishes between the members of the two teams. Felt like a bit of an Eddie Kingston or a Miro match, maybe in AEW, which in turn, especially Kingston's, are obviously inspired by various aspects of Japanese wrestling. So it made sense. It came full circle, I suppose, that this was a Japanese inspired match done by, you know, two Westerners or two English-speaking wrestlers, but in Japan. So I like that. This was in Currican Hall, and they brawled up into the stands, which was all right. Maybe got a little bit silly when the ref just followed them round rather than trying to count them out. But apart from that, I enjoyed pretty much everything they did, especially once it got back to the ring. And this was really what it should have been, just two big scary guys doing scary things to each other and helping each other look like monsters as well. There's lots of macho posturing, of course, only to be met with very hellacious punishment from the other guy. It also had a unique ending with Hanare delivering a huge headbutt that knocked both men out. They were both down for 10 seconds and it finished a draw. And I don't mind a draw in wrestling. There's another one later on that I'm going to talk about in this episode. And yeah, Gabe Kidd versus Hanare, I really enjoyed. Not as much as the two matches I talked about just before at the New Beginning in Osaka itself, but this Road 2 match was very decent indeed. So that is the New Japan section. Now let's head to a promotion you may have heard of called the bloody WWE, because they were in Australia, weren't they? Do you see what I've done there? Yeah, let's go.
Aussie, Aussie, Aussie!
Tonight, the center of the universe can be found in Perth, Australia.
Up on top of a pod.
Oh my God!
The sunset flip power. The top of the pod! Strider launches herself off the pod! LA Knight covered for the win!
What the hell? AJ Styles!
Hell, AJ Styles come back!
Styles is mangling LA Knight with a steel chair!
Logan Paul can do anything he wants with the brass knucks!
Oh, KO!
So yes, Elimination Chamber was in Perth, Western Australia. And there's various matches I want to talk about. Although the prevailing feeling about the show seems to have been from everybody, how sparse it was and how long the gaps between these few matches were. Especially given the fact that one of the big segments of the show was a non-wrestling segment, the Grayson Waller effect with Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins. And that took up a lot of time as well. So it did make the show feel really stretched out, almost too much perhaps. I thought the matches themselves were, it wasn't like a blowaway pay-per-view or anything, but I thought it was very solid throughout. There's a few matches I want to focus on. The main event, I think it was wise to have Rhea Ripley win in the main event and have her be the big hero at the end. The match was okay. It wasn't one of my matches of the month, but it very much did the job, and Rhea and Nia did what was required of them. The women's chamber match was maybe my favorite match of the night. Great stuff. The only issue I had maybe was that the winner was very predictable. We all knew that Becky Lynch was going to come out of this with the win. They really have set up Becky versus Rhea Ripley at WrestleMania ahead of time. So it was no surprise to see Becky win. I think the biggest story of the match actually was Tiffany Stratton and the reaction she very deservedly got. It certainly, I've got in my notes here, it really was Tiffy time. And it was. And her swanton off the pod was terrifying. I'm glad she's okay. It was, she did really well. I love the fact that the crowd got on board with her so much. And were even booing baby faces who were beating her up. And when she got eliminated, I think by Liv Morgan, they booed Liv. Liv was great in the match. All six of them did really, really well in this match. And I really enjoyed it. Even though, as I say, we all knew Becky Lynch was going to win. And she did. The men's chamber was also good. I maybe preferred the women's one slightly. But this one was very good too. This felt very sports entertaining rather than like a brutal chamber match or anything, as we've come to expect in the modern age. But we did get some hard-hitting moments going on as well. Spears through the pod and that sort of stuff. Brawls inside of a pod, like when Kevin Owens trapped Logan inside and everything. Very good. Logan Paul was great, of course, as he always seems to be. I also thought Randy Orton was very good in this one. And again, maybe the match had a predictable winner in Drew McIntyre. Maybe not as predictable as Becky, but he was certainly the favorite heading in, I would say. But even if the winner was maybe predictable, I don't think the manner of victory totally was. With Logan obviously not leaving the chamber when he was eliminated and instead screwing Randy Orton. We also had LA Knight getting screwed as well by AJ Styles. And it felt like this was like very storyline heavy chamber match setting up WrestleMania. And I don't mind the chamber as a device in that regard. So, yeah, I enjoyed both chamber matches. I also enjoyed the tag title match, the new Catch Republic of Tyler Bate and Pete Dunne, Damian Priest and Finn Balor of the Judgment Day. Really good tag match. Again, perhaps a predictable outcome, but it's nice to see Pete and Tyler finally given a chance to have these really high work rate matches on a main roster pay-per-view. This really drove home for me how long they'd been in limbo, especially Tyler Bate, who went from, I mean, I said this on the podcast, when I'm recording this on the same day that we did the weekly podcast, and I mentioned how Tyler went from having like a match of the year contender against Gunther in NXT UK, and then just spent ages doing nothing in the American NXT, having like the occasional really good match, but not being a focus of that brand at all. And now finally, he's back with Pete again, and Pete Dunne himself has spent what feels like forever stuck in this Butch gimmick, which I'm glad he's been able to ditch now. And hopefully this team, this new Catch Republic, is the start of something new. Even if it doesn't last very long and it leads to Pete maybe turning on Tyler and they renew that old feud, wouldn't mind that at all because I think Pete's an excellent heel. But I'm happy for the minute with them just having something more worthwhile to do and having these high work rate pay-per-view matches because it's what these guys were born to do. Elimination Chamber was not the only WWE show, that I wanted to mention because obviously Cultaholic's favorite brand was in action with NXT Vengeance Day. I watched this show with Ross. We did live stream reactions together. And to be fair, we had a blast watching it. Like, it was so much fun. There's several matches that I want to mention. The opener, Trick Mello Gang taking on the Wolf Dogs. So that's Trick Williams and Carmelo Hayes versus Baron Corbin and Bron Breakker. The story here was that Trick was pulling double duty on the night. He and Mello had got to the final of the Dusty Classic tournament. But also, Trick had to fight in the main event because he's challenging Ilya Dragunov for the NXT title. The match felt wild and out of control, but in like a good way. Even with Bron Breakker's weird, calling it a botch is a bit unfair because it was just a freak accident. But when he's like running the ropes so fast that his head slipped under the top rope at one point and his neck like jolted back and forth, really scary moment. Thankfully, he was okay. And they made a joke about it on the following week's NXT. But apart from that, the match felt wild and out of control in a good way, as I say. The Wolf Dogs are brilliant. The crowd love them, even though they're heels as well. And they had so many cool moments, specifically the one where Braun launched Baron Corbin over the top rope into like an impromptu dive from Corbin. So really good stuff. You add sprinklings of a storyline for later on with Melo seemingly helping Trick to not get hit with a move, like taking the bullet, but it cost them the match instead. And that leads us to later on in the night as well. So really good opener, really fun stuff. A match from a feud that I'm finding strange rather than enjoyable was Dijak versus Joe Gacy, kind of a no DQ stipulation. Really fun as well, really fun hardcore brawl. Dijak's character in NXT is not that easy to get behind, in my opinion, because he's just cool heel man who's sadistic as well and loves dishing out punishment. Gacy's like this indestructible, weird creature who just loves taking punishment. But it feels like nearly all of Dijak's feuds have, maybe not all of them, but like the one against Ilya Dragunov had very similar themes. Dragunov loves the pain. Gacy's more of a comedic figure, but it's similar themes, maybe a bit too similar, a bit too soon. But the match itself was really fun. Kind of mixed together elements of comedy and hardcore stuff. There was duct tape being taped around the eyes of Dijak. There was the use of Lego. It was really satisfying and hard-hitting and all the things you want a good hardcore match to be. The women's title match was a lot of fun. And of all the matches heading into TakeOver, and it's not called TakeOver Vengeance Day. What am I doing? It's just NXT Vengeance Day, that's right. Of all the matches heading into Vengeance Day, this was the one I was least excited about, which totally defied my expectations. Not because I'm not a fan of the women involved, Lyra Valkyria and Roxanne Perez, who are both excellent in-ring workers. I just didn't buy the feud, really. I thought, the story's not good. They're both plucky, smaller kind of workers, you know. They're real wrestlers. But I didn't think the feud had much of a bite to it or much fire. I've been totally proven wrong since, because Roxanne's turned heel and she's gone off the deep end. But here, she was a frustrated babyface challenger. Lyra is the honorable babyface champion. And I thought, how is this going to be? It'll be an excellent worked match, an excellently worked match. But how is it going to have the intensity required? And it totally did. Part of that is because, obviously, in WrestleMania 31 fashion, Lola Vice cashed in her title shot mid-match. She won the breakout tournament. That gave her a contract to cash in at any point. She did so here, and suddenly everything was elevated. Everything felt more exciting. Like, is she going to be able to do this? Is she going to steal the title? And Lola Vice, even though she's not the most experienced, has a really distinctive in-ring style. And I like that a lot, because a criticism of the Performance Center often is that they create superstars who all wrestle in a very similar way, whereas Lola Vice has just enough of that own, her own sense of flair and something that sets her apart, which is her MMA background. So she throws strikes in a really unique way. They look good, they look crisp, dangerous, and she moves slightly differently to other wrestlers, which is great to see. And it really stood out here in a match with two wrestlers who aren't products of the Performance Center. They had a really good indie careers beforehand, but who are good enough to wrestle in that Performance Center way. So the contrast of styles really worked. The match was very exciting, and I really enjoyed the finish with Lola not being able to successfully cash in, but in fact allowing Lyra to retain the title, thereby giving Roxanne Perez a further grievance, which would eventually tip her over the edge and become a heel, because her match got interrupted. It got turned into a triple threat that she wasn't ready for. So I like it. And obviously, sometimes the best heels are the ones with a bit of justification to their actions as well. Really good stuff. And obviously the main event, probably my favourite match of the night. Even though Trick Williams is still quite a raw talent, not a raw brand talent, like he's naturally talented, but not as experienced is what I mean, obviously. Even though he is that, he's just got the it factor. He looks great. He's exciting. The crowd love him. Ilya Dragunov's fantastic as well, and has been putting together a title reign in NXT, which although it hasn't been, I've not enjoyed every feud that much or the build to every match. Almost every time Ilya's pay-per-view matches or special PLE matches really pay off. Like, he always delivers in the ring. And with Trick, it was no exception. This match was intense, hard-hitting. Both guys, I think, got busted open a hard way. Some of the moves down the stretch, they both put a bit extra on the moves, especially Trick's flying knee towards the end where he was like spit. Like, he hit the move but had flown totally out of control. It had the stuff with Carmelo Hayes, of course, who accidentally on purpose chop block Trick, which would lead to Trick losing the match and Ilya keeping the belt. And then we had the aftermath, which added to everything as well, with Carmelo finally pulling the trigger, turning on Trick and becoming the biggest heel on the brand. Hopefully setting up what would be a massive stand and deliver feud, blood feud, grudge match type thing between the two former friends. So I really liked it all here, pretty much. There were one or two matches that didn't rise as high as some others, and that's okay and everything. Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. I don't know what to say, because I don't know what to make of NXT, where the weekly stuff, like we dissect it on the podcast and laugh about it, I find a lot of it to be poorly written. But the pay-per-views always deliver, and I guess that's a testament to the talent they've got in that roster. So fair enough to everybody for pulling together what was a very enjoyable NXT show.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Box shot, he's going box shot. Box shot, no. Swear. Here it is. JML driver.
Oh my God.
He's hurting though, he can't cover. Every second that goes by. Come on.
Ladies and gentlemen, the time limit has expired. This match is a draw.
Wow. Oh, man. A 30-minute time limit draw. You're out of touch.
I'm out of time. And now on to the miscellaneous section of matches of the month, where I just look at some other matches that I've forgotten to mention. We've not mentioned AEW yet, but don't worry, AEW fans, because next month's episode is going to be very AEW heavy, because obviously we had Revolution at the start of March, and that featured a lot of good wrestling. There are some AEW matches I'm going to talk about here as well. First one being the third big singles match between Hangman Adam Page and Swerve Strickland. When I drive, it's the best entrance in wrestling at the minute. This was certainly, how do I put this, the least pay-per-view of their three big singles matches so far, but that's okay, because it was also not on a pay-per-view, whereas the other two were. Unlike maybe all American people, I quite like a draw. I don't mind a draw. This one ended in a time limit draw, and I thought it was full of very good storytelling down the stretch, especially Swerve's knee giving him just enough trouble to delay that final pinfall attempt by a second, which turned out to be a second too long, as time expired, obviously, just before the referee made the count of three. The stuff in between the big moments throughout the match wasn't maybe as tight as we're used to seeing from these two previously. It maybe didn't feel quite as intense because it's following their Texas Death Match, which was like the most intense match possible. So it was never going to be able to live up to that in terms of intensity, but it was still certainly a very, very good TV match. The big moments here were great, especially the dead eye through the table on the outside, which looked like a terrifying bump to take. But the way this could work, this might work as an example of like a microcosm of what I'm trying to say. The setup of the table felt a bit sloppy. Not because, all right, they had to set up a second table because one just collapsed very lightly. And I didn't mind that. That's just one of those unavoidable things that sometimes happens in wrestling. But then Swerve went and got another table, set it up next to the original one, and then just grabbed Hangman and got the match back in the ring. And I'm thinking, no, why logically would you have gone and got another table and then just continued the match? It's such a minor thing, but it's just one of those little things that made the glue, the connecting tissue of the match, not feel maybe as good as its bigger moments. Thankfully, though, these big moments, which everyone's, you know, remembers, which we'll all remember the most, were very good. Like the time limit draw at the end, like the dead eye through the table, like Swerve stealing the Buckshot Lariat, for example, and all that sort of stuff. That was all very, very good. I'm not sure how I feel about heel Hangman, because I love Hangman Adam Page. I'm a huge fan, and I just really enjoyed cheering him as a babyface or as a conflicted sort of tweener that he was when he lost his confidence. Now he's an out-and-out heel. I just want to cheer him. But at the same time, I can concede that he is doing a good job as a heel. His slightly changed look with the big mustache looks good. He looks like a proper heel. He is performing his heelish role very well. I just really like him and I want him to be a face. But he, as I say, I will concede he's doing a very good job of it. Swerve, by the way, is on a roll, of course. My only fear is that they delay it too long. I just hope they give him that belt sooner rather than later. As much as I enjoy Samoa Joe as champion, give Swerve the belt. Especially if, as many people have theorized, if Swerve is eventually going to drop that to Ospreay at Wembley at All In, you want him to have a decent title reign before that, a decent length one, which I think means giving him the belt very soon. Maybe at the next pay-per-view, that the Dynasty one that they've just announced, which is before the time of recording, so we'll have to wait and see. Hangman v Swerve 3, great stuff. Not as good for me as their previous two matches on pay-per-view, but that's okay. That was a very high bar to live up to, so I'm not going to judge them too harshly for that. Another AEW TV match, this one on an episode of Collision, was another Bryan Danielson match. He features so much on these monthly recaps, and I mean, he's one of the greatest of all time, so it isn't too much of a surprise now, is it? I enjoyed this match he had against CMLL star Hechicero. And in my notes I've got, I've put here, Hechicero is such a weirdo, man. I love him. And that was my thought watching this. This was, I believe, the first Hechicero singles match I've ever seen. And I thought he was a little weirdo, well, a big weirdo, but a very entertaining one. From his weird little mannerisms to his very unique orthodox style, I really loved what he was doing here. I also enjoyed that Brian was just as confounded as we were as viewers, because Brian didn't know what to make of him. And whereas Brian can out-technical most of his opponents that he faces, this guy was just unorthodox enough, while also still being a technical wizard, apparently his name literally does mean wizard, that Brian was just, yeah, he was flabbergasted. He was stumped for a while and then had to kind of figure out a solution to this puzzle that was Hechicero. And I thought it was wonderful. I can totally see why the match was put together. They complemented each other's styles brilliantly. And I loved the crowd reaction as well. They got on board very naturally, very easily with Hechicero. And I would love to see more of him in AEW. So that was a really cool TV match. Really enjoyed it. And the final match, I want to take a quick trip to Stardom, which was for the High Speed Championship, which is like their cruiserweight belt. May Sayra, I believe it's pronounced, May Sayra defending against Hazuki. Hazuki has featured on matches of the month before. May Sayra has not. This was maybe the first match I've seen of hers. Definitely the first one. Or maybe did I see the one where she won the belt? This is at least the first one that's featured on matches of the month anyway. And she's very young. I think she's in her early 20s. And as the name of her championship suggests, and perhaps requires, she is capable of wrestling at a very high speed. Hazuki can match her almost, and it makes for a very nice encounter. These two women were just whizzing around the ring at each other. At certain points, I felt like Hazuki was trying to slow it down a little bit. Not because she couldn't keep up, but in kayfabe, she's trying to slow it down. She knows that this girl has her beat in terms of pace, so she's trying to hit more powerful moves or slow the match down or grind out a submission win, but she just can't keep Sayra down because she's the high-speed champion, goddammit. So yeah, it was a really good dynamic. I don't know what I've just said there. I got too excited. They are just flying around the ring at each other. And again, It was a draw. This one, a time limit draw. I didn't enjoy the finish too much, which was Hazuki hitting a big brainbuster, making the cover, getting immediately rolled up. But the bell had already rang. Now, I don't think Mei should have been able to roll her up after taking that really gnarly-looking brainbuster. That's very minor, but it did come at the end of the match, so it does stick in my head. But yeah, it was a good draw. Kept Hazuki strong as the biggest star of the two, while also allowing the champion to retain her title and not lose, which is better than if she'd just, you know, won in cheap fashion, I suppose. The draw here actually did both women quite a service. So yeah, good start of match. In fact, a lot of this month was fun. I've not mentioned as many matches this month as I sometimes would have done. Quality, when it reached the top level, was very high indeed. So we'll have to see how this all shakes out in my lovely lists at the end of the episode, which are happening now. Let's start with the top 10 matches of February. At number 10, one of the matches I've just talked about, Bryan Danielson versus Hechicero on AEW Collision. Number 9, I've gone for the men's Elimination Chamber match. Number 8, I've gone for the women's Elimination Chamber match. Number 7, Lyra Valkyria versus Roxanne Perez, which then became a triple threat featuring Lola Vice as well at NXT Vengeance Day. Number 6, Hangman Adam Page versus Swerve Strickland in that time limit draw. Number 5, another time limit draw, this one in New Japan, Hanare versus Gabe Kidd in Currican Hall. Number 4, the Wolf Dogs versus Trick Mello Gang, Bron Breakker and Baron Corbin versus Carmella Hayes and Trick Williams, the opening match of Vengeance Day. Number 3, the main event of Vengeance Day, Ilya Dragunov versus Trick Williams. Number 2, Bryan Danielson versus Zack Sabre Jr. in the New Beginning in Osaka in Japan. Really good rematch from their classic last year. Not quite on the same level, but still very enjoyable indeed. And number 1 from that same event, oh god, I'm going to get pelters for this and for not putting Osprey Oku in my top 10. United Empire versus War Dogs in the hour plus long cage match of doom, death and destruction. I absolutely loved it. Sorry if you think it was really overblown. I know, but I can't help what I love, okay? So let's see how the overall match of the year standings shake out, even though we are, of course, only 2 months in. Number 10, North Wrestling, my local indie, Leon Slater versus Speedball Mike Bailey. Number 9, the triple threat from Wrestle Kingdom, Will Ospreay, John Moxley, and David Finlay. Number 8, another John Moxley match, this time taking on Shingo Takagi in a no DQ contest. Number 7, Shingo Takagi versus Masaaki Mochizuki. Shingo going back to his old promotion and taking on maybe the best 50-plus-year-old wrestler in the world today. Number 6, Ilya Dragunov versus Trick Williams. Loved it from the main event of Vengeance Day. Really, really intense. And the big dramatic twist at the end, of course, as well. Number 5, TNA, Will Ospreay versus Josh Alexander. Number 4, Bryan Danielson versus Kazuchika Okada at Wrestle Kingdom. Number 3, my favourite match of last month, was just a really short 12 minutes or so TV match between Darby Allin and Konosuke Takeshita, which was epic. It was perfect for what it was. Number 2, Bryan Danielson versus Zack Sabre Jr., the rematch from last year, which I've just talked about. And number 1, of course, the United Empire versus the War Dogs in that hour-long, weird, epic main event. Loved it. So there you have it. Those were my matches of the month for February. If, like last month, there are any glaring omissions that I've left out, please do shoot me a tweet at JackTheJobber and also recommend any matches for the upcoming episode, which is March. Then, beyond that, I'll be doing, hopefully, a WrestleMania week special because there's like a month's worth of matches crammed into 1 week, of course, at the start of April. And then at the end of April, there'll be like a standard April edition. But I always look forward to WrestleMania weekend or WrestleMania week, so there will be a special dedicated episode of Matches of the Month. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you next time.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
For all the wrestling headlines in just 10 minutes, search Cultaholic Wrestling News on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.